This is Vanderbilt University's Beyond the Lab, a series where we interview biomedical science alumni about their career path and what they do in their current jobs. I'm your host, Kate Stewart, and we have a fun, longer episode for you today. Back in 2015, at the annual Career Symposium, our office hosted alumnus Dr. Efrain Garcia to speak to our graduate students and postdocs about his role with the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority within the Department of Health and Human Services. At that time, we interviewed Dr. Garcia for the Beyond the Lab video series. We're going to play that interview shortly. But just this year, Dr. Garcia was invited to come back to campus to speak at the Vanderbilt Pharmacology Department retreat as their keynote. So we conducted a follow-up interview with him to talk about what he has learned since. And we'll play that interview also in this episode. So we hope you enjoy this episode. Stay tuned after both interviews to find out more information about the podcast and our office. Welcome to Beyond the Lab, a series by the Office of Career Development within the Biomedical Research, Education, and Training Department of the Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. I'm Kate Stewart, and I'm here today with Efrain Garcia, who graduated with his degree in pharmacology in 2007. So I'm so glad you're back. Welcome back.
Thank you, Kate.
So tell me a little bit about what you did here at Vanderbilt when you were here.
I was a graduate student in the Department of Pharmacology in the laboratory of Elaine Sanders Bush, who is no longer with Vanderbilt, but she was here for 30 years. And my research focus on studying G proteins and how they are related to hallucinogenic drug action.
Okay.
The title of my thesis was actually Unraveling the Role of G Proteins in Hallucinogenic Drug Action. And I was here for a little over 6 years. And then after that, I did a small postdoc also here at Vanderbilt at the Vanderbilt University Institute of Imaging Science. Mm-hmm. And I did a clinical fMRI. And after my postdoc, then that's when I started my career, which I presume you're going to ask.
Yes, I'm going to ask you next. Tell me about your path since your time here at Vanderbilt.
So I was one of those, I guess not so much nowadays, but in the past, I was one of those students that knew from very early on that bench science, although important and very interesting, maybe wasn't the path that I wanted to follow. So very early on in my career, I started looking at different ways for me to become a better candidate for a different career path. I thought I was good with people. Maybe I could do some PR for a pharmaceutical company, considering that I have the science and the people skills for that. But then I found an advertisement for the AAAS Science and Technology Policy Fellowships. I found it to be very interesting because that addressed what I always said that I wanted to do, which was big picture science. So I want to see the impact of science beyond the lab, if I could use the term. And so since then I started thinking, and my mentor who was terrific, the both of us started thinking about what I could do to become the best candidate possible to become a AAAS fellow. So at that point, I started volunteering for every seminar, every symposium at Vanderbilt to organize it. I volunteered at the Adventure Science Center. I met with members of Congress in DC and in Nashville. I organized a symposium for neuroscience and brain disease burden in Zambia in Africa. I did everything in my power, at least anything I could do to make sure that I would be a qualified candidate for the AAAS fellowships, and unfortunately I was able to get it. I interviewed in two different tracks, a diplomacy track and a health education and human services track. I chose the latter one. And how the AAAS does this is that after you go through the application process, which is quite lengthy, I don't know if you want me to talk about that.
Sure.
You first have to fill out an application, and they give you different criteria, and it's pretty much trying to understand where you come from, where your scientific skills are, and how you have applied those science skills outside of the lab. So they want to make sure that you are a well-rounded individual, that you are not only able to perform good science, but you are able to communicate it and apply that science, again, outside of the lab. So after that first step, once your application is selected, which is a very intensive process, and it's a lengthy application, you have to make sure that you follow the parameters they have in their website as to what an application needs to look like. Following that, you become a semi-finalist, and at that point, you have an oral interview, which is a 30-minute interview, and they ask you to write a briefing memo, which I didn't know what a briefing memo is. I think the majority of us wouldn't know what a briefing memo is, but the beauty of becoming a PhD is that if you don't know it, you can't figure it out. So you figure it out. I wrote my one-page briefing memo. A couple of weeks later, you have an interview. They ask you questions about the briefing memos, your briefing memo, questions about you, and questions about how, you know, something that is related to policy issues of today and your views on them. And then they give you a closing statement, and then that determines whether you become a finalist. And what it means to be a finalist is that then you are able to interview in different agencies within your track. Since I was in two tracks, I was able to interview in State Department and things that relate to diplomacy, as well as NIH, NSF, HHS. And I ended up at HHS, at the Office of the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, mm-hmm. or BARDA. And we're in charge of funding the advanced development and procurement of medical countermeasures for chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear threats, as well as pandemic flu. We act as a venture capitalist in the government, pretty much, you know, because these things don't have a commercial value. A lot of them, antibiotics could, but mm-hmm. like say a vaccine for anthrax is not something that people go to CVS to buy. So we have to give these companies the incentive to go. We say you get them through early on research with presumably NIH money. Mm-hmm. But once you get to that spot, we are able to provide funding for you to conduct advanced research, phase one, phase two, and then leading to regulatory approval if the product is successful and shows efficacy and safety. And then for some products, if we have a requirement for procurement, then we are able to purchase those medical countermeasures. And then we also interact with many different agencies, because once they are purchased by us or procured by us, they are CDC would manage the stockpile. So that was pretty much my path. Initially, I started doing policy mm-hmm. When I came to my fellowship, and that policy related to the developmental requirements for these drugs that I was talking about. Then afterwards, I also did some international preparedness and response. I was the branch chief of international partnerships for biosecurity and preparedness, and international preparedness and response, things like Ebola, things mm-hmm. like MERS coronavirus, SARS. And then again, I went back to BARDA, and which I now manage these projects for the advanced development of medical countermeasures for chemical threats. So. Okay. That's my long spiel about what I've done after grad school.
Okay, good. No, that's a great path. But what do you do every day? Like, you walk into the door, what's a typical day look like for you?
Well, I'm sure, you know, it does obviously vary day by day. But in a nutshell, what we provide by being the managers of these multi-million-dollar contracts is that we ensure that these companies are producing the data that we need, that they would need for regulatory approval, but mm-hmm. that we think that they would need for this pathway leading to regulatory approval. So we interact with them very regularly. We have teleconferences, we do site visits, we review their reports, and we also, something that is very unique, is that we provide subject matter expertise to them too. So we mm-hmm. are a resource for this company. So we're not only funding the development of these things, but we have teams of experts where we work, and we're able to provide this expertise to these companies, which is very, it is very beneficial for them, because we have direct interactions with FDA, we have direct interactions with NIH. So we're able to provide guidance as to where they should go with this product. So we have constant interaction with them. We also have interagency meetings in which we talk about, because a lot of the things that we do, say, especially in the chemical field where I concentrate mostly now, DOD, Department of Defense, also has a program for that. So we want to ensure that we are joining forces to ensure that we all have a common goal, although they are more for the war fighter and we are for the civilians. We want to make sure that the products are being developed in a cohesive manner to make sure that we are not reinventing the wheel agency mm-hmm. through agency. We also need to interact with FDA to ensure that we are able to get these drugs to regulatory approval, which is, we have something called the animal rule, because a lot of these drugs, you know, you cannot give anthrax to a person. So what these companies have to show to get these products approved is that they are efficacious in at least two animal models, mm-hmm. but safe in humans. And then once you prove that, demonstrate that, then you are able to then proceed into the regulatory pathway. And if you're lucky, then your product will be approved. So we are always monitoring these things. So in a typical day, I have teleconferences, or I could be flying to their locations to do a site visit, or I could be reviewing proposals for funding. So it varies day by day. Like when I went, go back, I have this big review of, you know, 200 pages proposals for a contract. So that's something else that we do. So although it's not bench science, I get to see a lot of what I told you at the beginning, a lot of the big picture science, which is what I enjoy most. Mm-hmm. So I find it very satisfying.
Okay, so I'm sure you have to have a lot of skills in your tool belt to really do your job. What are some of the skills that you took from your PhD training that you use now? And then what are some skills that you would have had to gain in your role now?
So when you're in graduate school, you are pretty much managing a project, right? Right. You have your project, you have to manage it, you have to manage expectations. You have to learn how to deal with failure, which I think it's pretty much what graduate school trains you for, you know, because you do an experiment, it doesn't work, tweak it here, do it again, doesn't work, tweak it here. But all that, there's a lot of failure, but you are trained to see how to deal with this failure and how to steer a problem until you find a given solution. Mm-hmm. So all those project management skills, all the organizational skills that you learn in graduate school, but particularly the problem-solving aspect of graduate school, has been very helpful and very translatable to what I do nowadays. I deal with, you know, contractors. And something that I think was helpful for me too was, particularly in pharmacology, we had a communications class, and we present in lab meetings, we present in seminars, work in progress. These interactions with people are very, very helpful, because when you go into these positions, you no longer interact with mice, which they don't talk back with you. So this is very interesting too. If you have those types of people skills that you could develop, and graduate school doesn't necessarily teach you people skills, but it does teach you to deal with people of diverse backgrounds and manage meetings, all that is translatable pretty much to any job, but particularly a job that deals with managing a large project.
Okay. So what are some things that you wish you knew in your PhD training that you know now in your current role?
I would say that change isn't bad, because as a grad student, we are so used to being in one lab, having one project. Your pathway is pretty much the same, and then you get something in your mind as to what you want to do, and that is the pathway you follow. We're very focused, you know, very tunnel vision. We have a goal and we go towards that goal. But when I after I left, and I realized, you know, I might enjoy a job, but I might want to learn a different skill. It's okay to change. They're not going to hate you. You especially if you don't burn bridges. Because in my case, I actually left the agency that I'm currently on now because I had a great opportunity. They understood it was a great opportunity. But at one point, they asked me if I wanted to come back, and I kind of missed the science that I do deal with, and I took that opportunity. And I was able to change again. So I have been in many different positions, in more than I thought I would be by this stage of my career, mm-hmm. and that's a good thing. So just knowing that, relax, it's okay if you don't know what you want to do, because you can always change. And you don't necessarily need to get your dream job the first time around. So just learning that was has been helpful for me.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for coming. Welcome back, and thank you for your time today.
All right, thank you.
Hold on, don't go just yet. Now we're going to jump right into our most recent interview recorded this October. I was glad to sit down in my office with Dr. Garcia to have a more relaxed conversation about his work and his advice for us. So, here we go. Okay, so we're back today with Dr. Garcia, who we had you in 2015, the summer of 2015. And so you're back now. Where are we? Fall 2018.
Yes.
And pharmacology asked you back to be their keynote speaker for their retreat.
Is yes.
Was that yesterday? Okay. Mm-hmm. We're glad to be able to have a follow-up with you and talk with you.
I'm glad to be back.
Welcome back.
Thanks.
You have had some interesting things happen in the past 3 years, or it's all good?
Well, we have grown our program. Well, a lot of the things that have happened relate to the work we do,
yeah.
Which I work to develop drugs and therapeutics for chemical agents.
Okay.
And as you can tell by the current events, the events involving chemical agents have been, there's been a huge uptick since the Syrian conflict.
Mm-hmm.
They've even been used to assassinate the brother of Kim Jong-un
mm-hmm.
with a nerve agent. And the most recent nerve agent attacks in England that resulted in one death. Presumably with some Russian great nerve agent. So a lot has happened in my field.
Mm-hmm.
So in my work, as for work, we have definitely been increasing the not just our budget, but like our awareness. And we have been trying to address these threats that are happening today.
Okay.
And so we've been very busy establishing new partnerships
mm-hmm.
to develop medical countermeasures and thinking of what would be the best way to get these countermeasures to people, because unfortunately with chemical agents, you don't have days or weeks or months like you have with some of the biologicals, but you have minutes or hours. So we have to not just think about developing drugs, but how to get these drugs to people in an efficient and quick manner.
Right. Okay. So not stressful at all.
That's right.
What is that work-life balance for you? Do you have to be like on all the time? Like if something comes through and you have to stop and get to it?
Well, I actually think that I have a very good work balance. Work-life
balance.
I have a good work-life balance because we run these programs, right? And what it means is that we establish partnerships with companies to develop
sure.
the product. And I always say there is rarely a program emergency. You know, you're just pretty much doing a research project, an advanced research and development project. So I think that a lot of us do have an opportunity to contribute and work hard, but it also allows us to enjoy the things that we might like doing in life that do not involve work. That's not to say that we don't work hard. That's not to say that sometimes if there's an emergency, we have to drop everything and do whatever we need to do. But my work does allow me to enjoy things that are not related to work after, you know, I finish my day. And, you know, I'm able to most of the time enjoy my weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that part of the reason that I enjoy my job is because it allows me to enjoy the things that I like doing in life.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was looking at your title because we had you for PhD Career Connections this morning. And your title is the longest title I've ever seen of any of our speakers. It was like 3 lines long.
What?
Explain how long your title. So you.
Oh, my title.
Your title.
I thought I titled my talk.
Oh no no.
Yeah.
That your official role is senior
health scientist.
Health scientist.
But I'm also a project officer.
That's department in BARDA.
Oh, I am in the division of chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear medical countermeasures.
In
within. the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, or BARDA, within the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response.
Oh my goodness,
within the Department of Health and Human Services.
How does anyone know to wade through all of that, to know where to find you or to where to look? Or like, if they want to do what you do, how do they say, well, I don't know what, you know, what, where do I find a job like that? Or there's so many components in that. What is that? You know, how can they interpret that? Is that something I want to do? How do I, you know, what section should I research or look into?
Well, we do, our main mission is to develop medical countermeasures. Medical countermeasures are anything from devices to vaccines to therapeutics,
right,
to new technologies to deliver drugs, for example. So all those we consider medical countermeasures, mainly therapeutics and vaccines, but like the diagnostics and devices and things like that we also develop. So if for somebody to be interested in BARDA, we would want them to have an interest in drug development.
Okay.
Right? So that is what we all at the end of the day do. We have the as of today, BARDA has approved 42 medical countermeasures in the last 10 years. That is more drugs than any pharmaceutical company in the world.
Wow.
So we see the fruits of our work,
yeah,
and I think that's why I like it so much. But also, what we also do is that we are, we manage programs.
Mm-hmm.
We're a program management organization. Like we shepherd these contracts along, we shepherd these projects along. So you have to have both sets of expertise. You know, you want to know enough of the science to understand what it takes to get a drug from being in advanced research and development all the way through FDA approval. But you also have to know how to run a meeting.
Mm-hmm.
You have to know how to think strategically. You have to know how to deal professional with a pharmaceutical company, for example. So you have to have a very diverse set of skills to be successful at the job. And just being a good scientist is not enough.
Mm-hmm.
You really have to know how to be able to develop something from more than an idea, but from a concept and from a, you know, you might have a proof of concept in an animal all the way to getting a drug approved. So you have to really have a good understanding of the process, or at least a basic understanding of the process. You know, you learn a lot more by doing. But you also need to know how to efficiently and effectively run a project.
Okay.
Or a program. And, you know, that's a skill. And the beautiful thing about it is that that is a skill that you can take with you anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the government, mm-hmm, in the private industry, in academia.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody wants you to have some experience on how to run a program. And most, you know, whether it is academia or government or business, all these things come with money attached. You have to know how to allocate budgets, how to stay within budget, how to, determine whether the work that has been conducted deserve to be paid or not, and why. So you need a very wide set of skills for that job. And in terms of how to get there, well, there's many different ways, but typically they want you to have a certain level of experience in particularly project management.
Mm-hmm.
But I, as you might have heard from my previous interaction with the BRED office, I arrived to the U.S. government through a AAAS fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I arrived. And then once I got there, I was able to establish personal relationships, which at the end of the day is how you get
most
jobs, or like, you know, most opportunities come from knowing someone that is already there. And to know someone that is already there, it takes getting your foot at the door.
Right.
And to get you through the door, there's many different ways. I chose the AAAS fellowships, but, you know, there's many other ways that you can get there.
Okay. And so we were speaking sort of off mic about how you have been sort of in the hiring perspective now, in a team situation where you're doing some hiring, and there are some things that you actually are looking for when you're hiring. What are some of the things that you think, you know, your team, your, you know, BARDA in general looks for when they're looking for applicants?
Well, we're looking for someone that can be a team player. I think that's the most important thing. Nothing gets done where I work, but really nothing gets done anywhere unless you're able to interact with other people, unless you're able to work on a team. If you're someone that wants credit for everything, you probably should go into entertainment, you know, because most other things get done with a team, you know, and you should, that is the most important thing for me. Like when I was hiring, you know, many times you would come and you would get applicants that had a very good set of skills, you know, that they seem to be very experienced in the field and know a lot of things, but they didn't seem to have the interpersonal relationships that we would need versus someone that has, you know, a certain level of skills, but you could tell that they could still learn things. But if that person is someone that I know I would enjoy working with, that person can be taught those skills, but you cannot teach the other person to be a nice person. So I think the most important thing, at least for me, is to ensure that this person, yes, have certain level of expertise that would be able to allow them to carry out the job successfully. But most importantly, it is someone that can work in a team and is somebody that I'm going to enjoy seeing every day. Because at the end of the day, many times the work is not the actual work. The work is the people you deal with every day. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the most important thing for me when I was a hiring manager was determining, well, though you really, it's hard to determine that after an interview, but you can determine sometimes how people interact with you or the way they present themselves, whether it's somebody that might fit with your team or not.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Also, earlier you were telling me about the gems that you had said yesterday at the pharmacology retreat, because you were the keynote, which is awesome. And we found your old resume from back in 2007 when you were in our office. And so it's just kind of coming full circle, but you had some really good advice for the retreat yesterday, and you had 4 great points. And so I was hoping you could share those points with us, because sure, they are worth documenting anyway.
Sure. So yes, I did the retreat yesterday, and, I would say that if I can say so myself, I'm very good at giving talks about something, but giving a talk about anything is pretty hard. So that was the situation, the retreat. I was the keynote speaker. What does the keynote speaker mean? It's like, you can talk about whatever you want. And that doesn't narrow it down enough. So I said, well, if I were a student, what would I want to hear?
Yeah.
You know, and obviously I would want to hear about my career, because that's, you know, that is your main purpose by sure, going to school, is to make sure that you are able to get some good employment opportunity afterwards. And but I also, more than talking about what I have done throughout the years, I wanted to talk about what I have learned from those experiences. And I have 4 take-home messages. And some are applicable to, you know, students, but I think they're always, I think all of them are applicable to everybody and just to life in general. And my first one was to find a good mentor, or 2 or several. And many times your mentor is not your PI. Mm-hmm. So make sure that you have a mentor, because if it is a good mentor, they will be thinking about you, about your career goals, about your career opportunities, and they would try to provide advice to get you to where you want to be, or provide you some guidance as to, you know, based on your skills, what you could be good at. So having a mentor, especially early in your career, is very important. Later on, become a mentor. You know, it helps somebody else, help the next generation. So mentorship is very important. That was my first point. My second point was to learn the importance of the 80%. Very often in life, if you have 80% of the things going well in your life is good. 80% is pretty good. And most times we have more than 80%. We have 90%. We have 95%. But very often we only focus on that 20, 15, 5% that we do not have, and that rules our lives. But we completely ignore that 80, 90, 95% that we do have. And there's going to be opportunities, and there's going to be times in life in which you do not have 80%. And you are going to, well, if you're insightful and thoughtful, you're going to go back and say, oh man, I should have enjoyed that 80% when I did have it. Again, if when you're laying on your deathbed, I'm sure that that might not be, you might not have necessarily 80%. So, but you don't want to have the regret that when you did have it, you didn't appreciate it. Mm-hmm. So, and most times good enough is good enough. But we, as graduate students, beat each other, beat ourselves up very much. And we're very tough on ourselves. And I think not just as graduate students, but just as people. So, you know, we should give ourselves breaks. And sometimes if you reach a point in which 80% of things are good, you know, sit down for a minute, smell the flowers, and just be happy that you have 80%. So learn the importance of the 80%. Strive for 100%. But if you get to 80%, make sure that you appreciate the fact that you got to 80%. That was my second. My third one was that a PhD does not make you smart, but it makes you resourceful. And that you can take to the bank with you. That can be, that is that one thing that you can use in any discipline. Because a PhD teaches you just a very narrow, you know, aspect of science. But it teaches you a lot about life skills. It teaches you to be a problem solver. It teaches you to, you know, tackle a problem, find solutions, formulate a hypothesis, try things here, try things there, and then come up with the most, you know, reasonable solution. That is what life is about. That is what every job is about. And a PhD trains you very well for it. It trains you for failure. It trains you how to deal with failure, because as we know, there's a lot of that in graduate school. And a lot of people don't know how to deal with failure. I think graduate students that are very well positioned after you finish your PhD to know how to deal with failure and to not let failure destroy everything else, because you know how to deal with failure, and failure happens every day in every discipline. And if you have a way to cope and deal with it, you have something that some people and a lot of people may not have. So learn to appreciate what you learn. And it makes you, we know where to find things. You know, like you can become an expert about a topic in a short period of time because you know how to look for it and you know how to learn concepts. That, again, is, you can take that to any discipline. So just because you're not at the laboratory doesn't mean that the skills you learn in your PhD are not being utilized in your current life. Yeah. And my last take-home message, which I think is the most important one, is, you know, learn to redefine success. You know, I had in my presentation, I had what success meant for me at 9 years old and then what it meant to me at 27 after the fellowship and what it means to me now. And I realized that it has changed throughout the years. And when, you know, when I was nine, I wanted the big cars, the boats, the, you know, you know, like the good life. But what 9 year old doesn't, right? Then during graduate school at 27, you know, my main goal was graduating, getting my PhD. SSS fellowship was my goal. So that was what I consider success to be. Then when I got there, you have to achieve success. I mean, in this case, it's very easy to understand because I got the fellowship, you got the fellowship, you're done. That is no longer your goal. So it's easy to redefine success when it is as concrete as that. But my next, after my fellowship, what I thought success was, you know, getting the next position, getting, you know, becoming, having a team, driving policy or driving, you know, some sort of aspects of leadership in a company. And I was very fortunate to get an opportunity to lead some international partnerships for preparedness and response at HHS. And it was a great experience. But throughout the process, I realized that that was not something that was best suited for me. Something that you should do throughout life is not burn bridges. From BARDA, where I used to work, I kept in touch with them. And one of my older bosses always was asking me, you know, whether I wanted to come back. And one day I said, sure. And I came back and I have been extremely happy since I came back. I do love working where I work. I see the fruits of our work. I see the relevance of my work. Throughout my graduate school career, I was always looking for the so what. You know, mm-hmm. I thought proteases were important, but why do I care? You know, what does this mean? I am now in the place that is the so what for me. We get drugs approved. This is the end of the road of research, right? You know, and it's so satisfying to me. But it's because I have learned that redefining success is very important. I did sit down, particularly after the experience before coming back to BARDA, in which I had, by my definition of success, for many years, I have gotten to that point in which I had accomplished, you know, I had the big title, I had the big job. And after I left, I said, you know, what is success to me now? You know, and I thought, well, success to me now is making sure that I have, number one, a happy life, right? And what does a happy life mean for me is that I have enough time to spend with the people I love, with my friends, with my family, to enjoy doing the things that I like doing in life. And yes, to have a job that I enjoy, but particularly a job that allows me to enjoy the things that I like doing after work. That job does not only gives me the time, but it gives me the energy and it doesn't stress me so much that whenever I leave work, I cannot enjoy those things I like doing in life. Mm-hmm. And a job in which I respect the people I work with. I think that for most of the people that I meet in life, you know, usually most people like the subject matter of the work they work at. But liking the people you work with is probably the most important part because, you know, the work usually is a document, usually is a deliverable. And, you know, that's fleeting. It's a moment. But interacting with your coworkers is the whole day, right? And so when you put all those things together, I define success now as making sure that I am taking care of the things that I love the most in life, which is the time, spending time with my friends, spending time with my family, and, you know, doing the activities that I like doing after work, as well as having a job that I enjoy, and particularly a job that I work with people that I respect. And I receive respect from them. I think that that is how I define success now. And I think that everybody should stop at some point during their career, sit down for a minute and ask, what is success to me? And what, you know, what are the things that make me the happiest? And am I able, is my job giving me the opportunity to enjoy them? Mm-hmm. If it doesn't, fortunately, you have an education, and what education gives you is choice. And if you have choice, make sure you choose a job that does allow you to enjoy those things. If you never change what how you define success, if your definition of success as 27 is the same definition of success throughout the rest of your life, you'll be chasing for that 5% that you don't have forever, and you will completely ignore that 90% that you do have. So it is very important to define what success means to you throughout your life. And hopefully, at some point, you will be in a situation that, at least laboral situation, in which things are going so well that success to you means something else.
Awesome. That's all we had for you. Thank you for coming over and chatting with us and for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me again, Kate.
You're welcome.
If you like this episode and want to listen to others, go to our website, medschool.vanderbilt.edu/career-development. This podcast was made possible by a BEST Award from the National Institutes of Health, to Roger Shockley, Kathy Gould, and Kim Petrie at the Vanderbilt University School of Medicine, Office of Biomedical Research, Education, and Training. Most of these podcasts are originally a video interview, all available on YouTube. Visit our website in the episode description, or just go to YouTube and search for Vanderbilt Beyond the Lab. Thank you, and join us next time to explore what lies beyond the lab.